Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV-FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us. Today, we'll turn our attention to Burlington. First up, Burlington Mayor Moreau Weinberger will join us in studio to share his views about issues in that city. And after we check in with our friends from Talk Media News live from D.C., David White will join us and talk about the Vermont Development Conference. It's a conference that's coming up November 2nd in Burlington. And if we have some time, maybe a short segment with your phone calls on other subjects. But right now, it is my great pleasure to have in our WDEV studios, Moreau Weinberger, Mayor Moreau Weinberger. Good morning.
Hey, Mike. Great to be with you. It's my first time down here in Waterbury at the WDEV studios. It's great to be with you.
Well, thank you. It's great to have you here. Mr. Mayor, there are two items coming before the voters in November in Burlington that has generated some news. One is the building height changes in the downtown area, and the other is the capital improvement costs. Let's start with these two items. Why do you need to change the height requirements of buildings in the downtown area?
Yeah, great. Well, I'm excited to talk to you about both these issues, Mike. And let me start with the kind of big context, and I'll hone right in on the height question because I know it is the one on a lot of people's minds. I feel extraordinarily fortunate to be the mayor of the city of Burlington. It is clearly a wonderful place to live, to work, to visit, and that's true for a number of reasons, right? We have this wonderful lake right out our front, down at the base of the hill. We live surrounded by the mountains. We have strong institutions, a whole bunch of reasons. But a couple of the big reasons are that prior generations of Burlingtonians, going back, you know, to the 1800s and even before, have made substantial investments in public infrastructure that has been the basis for our quality of life and our economic development throughout the city's history. And we have also been willing and able as a city to take on big challenges. Some of the ones that I think of are building the breakwater during the 1800s that made Burlington the great lumber port and stone port that it was for decades. I think of the rebuilding, the kind of bold idea to take to build one of the first bike paths in the country along the shores of Lake Champlain, and that has become this great recreational, cultural, and economic development amenity for us. I think of the very bold decision to turn all of Church Street, which was a functioning street, but to say, you know, to stay a relevant downtown, we need to take on a big idea here and turn that into a pedestrian mall and then do the hard work necessary to make that successful. And I think we're at another one of these moments, Mike, where we need to do both of those things. We need to reinvest in that public infrastructure, which is a outstanding, rich public infrastructure we have, but that needs updating and that has some areas that we've chronically underfunded for some time. And we also really need to take some important steps to keep the downtown vibrant and strong as we enter a whole new period for commerce in the 21st century. And I think that's what the Burlington Town Center redevelopment, the redevelopment of these two central blocks of our downtown, is an attempt to do. So with that big wind-up, why the height change? And I know there's a lot of misinformation about this out there and misunderstanding, really. That people think we're raising the height because the developer has demanded that we raise the height. I think that's really a misunderstanding of how we got to where we are. We have had a two-year, very public, very transparent process that has involved a willing partner in the Devonwood, the owner of the Burlington Town Center property, these two central blocks of our downtown. That's involved the Planning Commission, that's involved the public, that's involved the City Council. And in that two-year period of time, the developer's original ideas have really changed quite dramatically. If you go back and compare what he's trying to build now to some of the earlier ideas, the early ideas didn't have streets running through them. Didn't reconnect Pine Street and St. Paul Street the way the design does now. They didn't. The early commitments weren't to high performance green buildings, LEED Gold buildings in this zone. There was not a commitment to cleaning up Lake Champlain, doing what the development can do to address our stormwater runoff issue. There was not commitment to have high quality design standards baked into the zoning so that we can be ensured, as we too often have not gotten in the past. We've had new buildings built in Burlington that really aren't good downtown buildings. They don't engage the street. They have doors in the wrong place. There are parking lots in the wrong place. This now in the zoning has these requirements that these will be really good buildings that add to the street life. All of these additional concepts and more, the developer is now committed to paying a livable wage to everyone who works on the construction project. It's a long list of things that have evolved over the course of these 2 years. And to make that all work, on this site, there have been all sorts of compromises and changes. And one of the things that did come out of this is because we are taking a substantial amount of land back from the developer, buying back from the owner these public right-of-ways, and we are requiring on the upper stories of these buildings, unlike the current zoning, we're requiring that the upper stories set back and don't kind of loom over the street the way the current zoning allows large buildings to loom over the street. Because of those things, to get a comparable size building to what he could build today on the site, we had to allow it to go a little bit higher. And let me reinforce that point, because I think it's a little confusing. People don't know this. The building that Don Sinex could build today on these two blocks could be a 1.6 million square foot building. The building, the maximum building envelope he will be allowed to build after the zoning passes, if it does pass from the voters, will be a 1.4 million square foot building. So there hasn't been this idea that there's been this sort of vast giveaway of new development rights to the property owners. It's just a misunderstanding of what's going on here.
But instead of being spread out, it goes up.
Instead of being spread out, it goes up. And I know some people aren't comfortable with that. Different people have different opinions about height. Some people look at the changes to the skyline and think, that'll actually add some interest to what Burlington looks like from the lake. And others, are unhappy about it. I guess the people who are unhappy about it, that I really hope people will grapple with as they go to the ballot box, because this really is in their hands now. After 2 years of work, it is the voters who are going to decide whether this thing goes forward or whether all of this effort, just collapses and results in nothing happening. What I hope they will consider is, I hope that people kind of look at this like there's a scale. And on one side of the scale, there are all of the positive things that will come from this development. There will be jobs in the downtown instead of seeing jobs go out into the suburbs, like we saw with the news with UVM Medical Center sending hundreds of jobs to the suburbs recently. There will be hundreds of new homes in the downtown doing something about our affordability crisis that is really straining Burlington's community and making us an increasingly less and less affordable place to live, to the point where now the average Burlington renter spends 44% of their income on rent. What that means is, we are pushing out the poor, the middle class, the disenfranchised from Burlington because housing is becoming increasingly precious. This is a chance to do something about that by adding some supply. So that should go on the positive side of the ledger. Also on the positive scale, people should see us doing something about the environment, doing something about cleaning up the lake because of those requirements in the zoning I just mentioned. They should see on the positive side taking this area of the downtown that's really been neglected and has streets that are not in good shape. This is not the attractive part of our downtown. Anyone who's walked down Cherry Street recently knows that this is not where you want to be in our downtown right now. This is, on the positive side, would be the reconnection of St. Paul Street and Pine Street and the just bringing new streetscape and life back to Cherry Street and Bank Street in a positive way. All that goes on the positive side and more. I shouldn't skip. Money should go on the people should see big dollar signs on the positive side of the ledger as well. This redevelopment will add tens of millions of dollars to state and city coffers over time in new property taxes being paid, new sales taxes being paid. Just in the local property tax alone, conservatively in phase one, we're estimating $2.4 million a year in new property taxes once just the first phase is redeveloped, flowing to the city and state. All that should go on the positive side. On the negative side, you really have concerns about height. What are those concerns? Well, there's a little more shadowing. There is an impact on the skyline if you're way down Pine Street or you're out on the lake. It's not going to be an impact you're going to notice if you're in the downtown near it.
How high are we talking about?
We're talking 160 feet is what the zoning limit will now be. That compares – that's modestly higher. That is modestly higher than any other building we have in the downtown right now. We have the Decker Towers project or the Masonic Temple. Both of those buildings get up to about 120 feet. So it is – or 125 feet. So it's modestly higher than that. It is important for people to know the way the height's going to work is it has to step back on the upper story. So from the street level, from anywhere close to the building, you will not see those extra 35 feet or so from the top. You will only be able to see that if you're really – back and you're getting some distance. I just hope people think about that scale. Think of all the good and think of, on the negative side for some people is a little more shadowing and some aesthetic impact. To me, it shouldn't be a close call. I think we've got to do this.
Yeah, the opponents will say this, that it changes the view and sort of the character of the city dramatically by having this building 160 feet tall in downtown Burlington. How do you respond to that? I guess.
Well, I did, but there's more to say about it. Let me say a couple more things. First of all, certainly the opponents are saying that, and they are also putting out images of what they think this building is going to look like. And some of these images that have been circulated are really quite inaccurate and misleading. I would encourage people to go to the city's website. They can get a very carefully done photo study that shows as carefully as we can, and this has been checked by our experts and what this development is going to look like from different parts of town. So people can go and they can scroll through. There are about 25 different views. They can see before and after shots, and they can – I think a lot of people are surprised when they do that how little impact this will have on the areas of the town that we think of as being sensitive and that we're worried about the character. Church Street, very little impact, visual impact from Church Street. The waterfront, you can barely see it from most parts of the waterfront unless you're in a boat way out in the middle of the lake. The character that's going to change, Mike, is the character of Cherry Street. It's the character of this part of town that really has not been a vibrant urban neighborhood since urban renewal, and we tore down this whole section of town. This is going to have new life brought back into it. There is going to be street life. There is going to be high quality, street trees and public amenities along these streets paid for by the new taxes generated by this project. Yeah, it's going to change the character vastly for the better. This is a huge step forward for Burlington's downtown.
What happens to Town Center if this project is rejected by the voters?
So there are two votes before the public that relate to this redevelopment. One is the zoning change. The other is this voter authorization of tax increment financing, bonding using tax increment financing. And that's kind of a wonky subject, and we probably should explain that. But I will say, I believe this is really now after a lot of people say, can't we just vote this down and come – there's a lot of good, they say to me, Mayor, they see there's a lot good in this, but couldn't this project just be a little bit – couldn't there be some compromise? Couldn't the building be just a little bit lower? I hope people, when they go to the ballot box, they realize that's not where we're at. There has been 2 years of compromises, as I said right at the beginning. This project has changed and changed and changed in response to what the city wants to see in this project, in response to what the public – has come out and said they want to see. At this point, it really is an up or down referendum. I think either the votes pass by a majority and we then move forward with the project, or it goes down and we really will have thrown away more than 2 years of work. And I think it's very uncertain what will then happen. I think people need to at least consider as a real possibility that the most likely outcome of going down is not some new positive, ambitious, slightly smaller project emerging, but instead we go back to what we had for 20 plus years, which is we had a 70s era suburban mall taking up two blocks of our downtown and increasingly declining as the internet age takes over, as people change their shopping patterns. I think we would be back to that, and we would really have lost this opportunity to take control of the future of our downtown, ensure through our proactive actions that it remains vibrant and relevant going forward. I think it would be a real huge setback.
We're speaking with Burlington Mayor Moreau Weinberger, and we're talking about happenings in the Queen city. Why didn't the city council just vote for this? Why does it have to go to the voters?
Well, let me be clear first. They did vote for it by a strong vote, 8-3. There was some opposition on the council. There was an attempt to block this at the council, and it didn't succeed. The councilors, eight of the 11 councilors who voted, one of them had to recuse himself. Otherwise, it would have been a 9-12. Supported this. So there is strong consensus within the people that really we have elected to protect the city and ensure the city's strong economically. They support this. The reason there is going to be a vote on the zoning as well is because there is a provision of state law that says that that basically empowers citizens, if they don't like a zoning change, to go out and get signatures and force a binding referendum on whether or not the zoning will go into effect. And it was clear that there is an organized group that doesn't like this change and is fighting for the status quo. And they're organized and they're working hard. And they probably would have gotten to that threshold. It's not a very high threshold to force a referendum on a zoning. So given that they had made it clear that that was their intention, I kind of thought about it and realized really the best course of action for the city was to have the council proactively put this item on as a referendum. What it does, instead by doing it that way, instead of waiting to have this petition effort do it, we save the money of a special election, which is, it's not nothing. It's more than $10,000. Ensure that the way things would have worked out is you would have had a special election right around the holidays or mid-January. You would have had much lower voter turnout at an election like that than you will on November 8th. So this really, by taking the action the council did last week, we've enfranchised a vast number of additional voters to weigh in on this issue. And then thirdly, time is an issue, right? I mean, someone who used to work in the I was an affordable housing developer. There was something that always weighed on me, the idea of time kills all things, and you would have been adding more weeks and really months to this important initiative if we waited for that special election to unfold. This allows us to essentially keep the current schedule. We already had the TIF vote going to the voters by putting the zoning on as well. We will have resolution one way or another on the future of this project on November 8th.
We're speaking with the mayor of Burlington, Mayor Weinberger. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Bob in Callis. Bob, you're
back
on with
Burlington.
The mayor.
I have a place in Callis. I have a Burlington Callis. Question. I just voted absentee in Burlington, mail ballot to me. There was nothing on there for the November election for this ballot issue.
Great question. I'm glad you're asking it. I'm sure there's some confusion out there about this. This is interesting. We are this year. Well, first of all, you're going to get a chance to vote. Let me tell you why it's working this way. The federal election deadlines this year have been moved up. They are much earlier than they have been in the past, and they aren't consistent with the state and local election deadlines. So what that means is, yes, the federal balloting has begun. The local ballot just was set last week, and we're going through the final steps of, getting it to the printer and getting the ballot finalized. The way we are going to kind of reconcile that disparity in the deadlines is this. For people like you, anyone who has already voted, as soon as the local ballot is done, we're going to mail you an absentee ballot for the local election and a return envelope, and so you're going to have an opportunity to weigh in. So,
I got my answer from all set.
Okay, great.
Thanks, Bob. Let's turn to before I take a break.
Can I just say, Mike? Bob doesn't need to do anything different. We're just going to automatically send it to anyone who has already voted. They don't have to worry that they got to go out and fill out some form or something. They're going to get a ballot.
Let's turn to capital improvements. What are the improvements that you're talking about when we talk about capital improvements, and why are they needed?
this also is an issue that we have been working on for more than 2 years. In the spring of 2014, my State of the City address, I identified really called out, signaled that we were going to do this citywide effort to really review what our infrastructure needs were going to be for the next decade, and find a way to have a comprehensive plan to address all of those needs. And we have been working hard on that ever since that speech. It is something that has engaged almost every department in the city. It has engaged many of the commissions in the city. And it's been exciting to think in proactive ways about how we responsibly steward the city's capital assets. I see this as kind of the last piece of this central effort that my administration has been focused on of, you know, putting the city's finances back together. If people remember when I got elected, we really were in trouble. We had just come through this in my first 2 months on the job, we saw the city's credit rating downgraded to the edge of junk bond status. We had a terrible audit that came out just as I was taking office. We were really in a we kind of downplayed this a little bit at the time because it was scary. We were not that far away from a fiscal crisis situation where the city might not have been able to make payroll, might not have been able to pay its firefighters and police officers. We were living off future tax revenues by the grace of one local bank. Had that bank decided they weren't interested in taking that kind of risk anymore, we could have been in a kind of fiscal crisis that would have really shattered the city for a long time to come. We've put that back together. We dealt with our liquidity issue. We settled the Burlington Telecom lawsuit on terms very favorable to taxpayers. We cleaned up our financial controls and got a clean audit the last couple of years. We've seen our credit rating shoot back up to an A rating, and we're hoping it's going to go even higher, get back to where we were, the double A rating that we had back in the mid-90s or the mid-2000s. We, for the last couple of years, that once we dealt with those sort of hot crises, we focused on pension reform, and I know you want to maybe get into that a little bit later, and we've made some progress there. The other big long-term financial area that I thought we need to focus on was infrastructure. I see, infrastructure, if you think about it, is a just core responsibility of local government. You go back and look at the speeches Burlington's first mayor was giving 150 years ago. What was he talking about? He was talking about streets. You know, this is what local government does. We build and take care of the streets, the sidewalks, the water pipes, the parks, the public buildings like the Miller Center and Letty Rink and City Hall, the garages, stormwater infrastructure, and on and on. And so we looked at each one of these asset categories, and we said, some of what we found is, you know, we do a pretty good job in a lot of areas. I mean, we have a long tradition of being kind of a full service city and taking care of these things. But we did find a number of areas where we had been sort of chronically underfunding the city, the infrastructure for some time. Streets, sidewalks are the biggest need. Sidewalks is one of the is a good example of this chronic underfunding. We were until a couple years ago with existing revenues, I've been able to kind of bump up the sidewalk investment a fair amount, about 80% in the last couple years. But still, we're well below where we need to be because we were only replacing about 1% of our sidewalks every year. If you think about that, that means you're only going to build, you're going to build a new sidewalk system over a 100-year period. Well,
yeah, I was just going to say you have a 100-year capital improvement.
Sidewalks don't last 100 years. You know, if you take good care of them and you're a little lucky, maybe they last 40 years. We've got to get onto that 40-year replacement cycle. Same thing with the bike path. We had neglected, we built this gem of a bike path 30 years ago. We didn't have an ongoing way to keep it up. And you can see that outside of the areas that we've been able to use federal money and state economic development money the last couple of years and rebuild. I hope people have seen that and they've experienced how great the rebuilt areas are. We want to do that for the entire 8-mile long bike path. We need to do something about our fire engine fleet. 5 of the 6 fire engines are essentially at the end of the year useful life. They're more than a dozen years old. And then the last big area, and there are a number of small areas, but the last big area is our water pipes. We have never had a proactive plan for replacing these water pipes. And as a result, we do have good records. We just haven't had a plan for replacing them. The records show that 42% of our water pipes are 75 years old or older. Our plan for replacing them is to wait until they break. Well, when do they break? They break in the middle of the winter during periods of real cold. They also tend to break, and there's a long list of streets where this has happened. They tend to break the winter after we have come in with heavy equipment and compacted the ground while putting down new pavement. So what does that mean? So that means we're in there replacing these lines at the most expensive time of the year, in emergency conditions at night. And we are digging up these brand new streets to do those repairs. That is not a responsible way of taking care of our infrastructure. This plan that we are putting forward is it's a $50 million plan over the next 5 years that will address all those areas I've just listed and really put us on a new keel going forward to be on a much better trajectory going forward.
When we come back, what I want to do is stay on capital improvements, talk about how much this capital improvement plan will cost and how these improvements are going to be paid for. We're speaking with the mayor of Burlington, Moreau Weinberger, and we'll be right back. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith, and in studio with me is the mayor of Burlington, Moreau Weinberger, who is we're talking about happenings in the Queen City. We've been talking about the downtown development of the city center?
Burlington Town Center is they call that property, yeah.
Burlington Town Center. And then we've turned our attention to capital improvements, and you're putting forth a capital improvement plan that's going to be financed by GO bonds and other ways of doing it. Let's turn to the capital improvement plan. How much will it cost, and how is it being financed?
Great. So what we're talking about is a $50 million five-year plan. And let me say just at the outset that we've worked really hard to keep that number down. I mean, that's part of what we've done over the last 2.5 years is to prune things out of this, focus on preventive maintenance. We are doing things now that we never used to do. We're using diamond saw blades to cut down sidewalks that have lifted up and get more years out of them that way. We are for the first time using sealing the cracks in our asphalt so we can get more years out of the roads. We are doing this preventative effort to reline our water pipes. So we're trying to keep costs down that way. We're also trying to keep costs down by, we've improved our credit rating, which is going to mean this thing is less expensive going forward substantially. We have been able to refinance a bunch of debt that has actually reduced our borrowing costs of existing debt. And I hope people have that in mind as they look at this. I fear people don't remember this, but if you compare your tax bill now to where it was 2 years ago, your municipal property tax bill is actually lower this year than it was last year, and it was lower last year than it was before. You're actually paying less. I think people don't believe that, and it gets kind of lost because you get the same tax bill. Also has the state education tax on it as well, and that has not gone down in those years, so people aren't paying less out of pocket. But we've worked really hard to take care of people's money carefully. How are we going to pay for this $50 million plan? Well, the answer to that is another area where we've really tried to keep the cost down for property tax owners, in that we have said, look, lots of people are going to benefit. Lots of different stakeholders are going to benefit from having good infrastructure. The businesses are going to benefit. The institutions are going to benefit. We need to make sure that all of the different groups, visitors, people who are coming here and enjoying Burlington, are going to benefit. All the different groups that are benefiting from this improved infrastructure should also be sharing in the burden of paying for it. So we have found a way to pay for 40%, more than 40% of this $50 million plan comes from non-property tax sources. It comes from philanthropy. I've gone out there hat in hand and gotten the hospital to kick in, I think, $350,000 for improvements along the bike path. People know Tony Parmelo has generously given money for the rebuilding of City Hall Park, which is also one of the things that comes out of this plan. About $2 million, all told, has come in through philanthropy. We're saying that if this plan goes forward, we looked at our stats and realized that our hotel tax is actually low compared to the national average. We're at about 11% combined between the city and the state. The national average is 13%. So visitors are going to if this goes forward, we'd increase the hotel tax a couple percent, and that would generate some significant revenues. We have gone to the institutions for more than a year. I've been talking with UVM and Champlain College about that, about the fact that they, you know, they really need to be part of this, and we're hopeful that that something is going to come from those conversations. We water fees are a piece of how this gets paid for. People will see if this goes forward about a 50-cent increase in their water bill on a monthly basis, and that will go up a little bit each year for the next 5 years after that. One thing to remember about water fees is that is an area where nonprofits, the institutions, the hospital, the colleges, they do pay their water bills. So that's a difference between that and property taxes, which fall all on property owners. Property taxes is part of this at the end of the day. I mean, that is our traditional way of financing these long-term bonds. It is a predictable way of financing these long-term bonds. So there is a $27.5 million general obligation bond that pays for about 60% or just shy of 60% of this plan. That is a big number. I hope people, as they will realize that we're going to take this down over a five-year period of time. We are doing this refinancing and these other measures to keep the cost low, so that the median Burlington homeowner owning a $231,000 home in the first year of this plan will only see their property taxes go up about a little more than $2 a month, and then it will go up from there again over the next 5 years. And we, you know, conservatively speaking, the maximum impact would be about $10 a month 5 years out from now. Now, that is, and we try to be honest about that and clear with people about that. I do think there's a scenario where you never end up actually seeing a property tax bill that is $10 a month higher than it is now, because if we succeed at some of this new some of the growth that we hope to see in the downtown, in other parts of the city, that would be spreading these costs over a larger number, you know, bigger grand list, and it might never get that high. So that, you know, and that kind of is maybe a good segue to another piece we haven't really called out as explicitly being part of this. That $50 million, it isn't part of the $50 million plan, but the TIF item, tax increment financing item on the ballot, will be money that will be up to $22 million spent on public infrastructure. It will be spent on this 8-block section of the downtown immediately surrounding the redeveloped Burlington Town Center site. And really, if our hope is, and we've got some good preliminary numbers on this, that we will actually be able to rebuild the streets from Cherry Street, rebuild Cherry Street from Battery Street to Church Street, so that whole 4-block section, as well as the Pine Street to Church Street section of Bank Street. So you would really have an 8-block section of the downtown rebuilt, not by turning the $50 million infrastructure plan into a $75 million or $72 million infrastructure plan that has to be shared by existing taxpayers. Instead, what is happening here, and this is really important for people to understand, and again, there's been a lot of misinformation about this, that the $22 million TIF money is not being paid by existing property taxpayers. We have negotiated this very carefully so that entire $22 million would be paid by new future property taxes generated by the redevelopment, the $200-plus million redevelopment of the Burlington Town Center property. So that's new property taxes that we won't have if the ballot items don't go forward and the project doesn't go forward. And 75% of that new property taxes is being put into this public 8 blocks of public infrastructure that has broad public benefits that we would want to get done regardless of what was happening with the town center, and we need to find some other way of paying for. This is not in any way, as it has been called out, a subsidy of the private improvements. None of this money is going to be spent on the private infrastructure. This is on public infrastructure that will be owned and managed by the city. And I think it's another exciting element of this plan. One last thing on this. Some people, the new taxes generated by the redeveloped town center are so great that not only is it going to be able to pay off over about a 15-year period that public infrastructure, there will be, from day one that the new development is open, hundreds of thousands of dollars of new revenues will be flowing to the city and to the state ed fund right out of the box.
Let's turn to one other issue before we take a break, and I want to take a phone call as well here. Let's turn to your retirement system. the pension liability that Burlington had. You had an underfunded pension system. What have you done to address that?
So this is an issue that was a major challenge. When I took office, we had a couple trends going on with our retirement system that were quite troubling. We had gone from having a system that was well-funded, more than 115% funded, if you looked out at the future liabilities and what was in the what was in the account, it had dropped from that level down to under 70% funded over a 15-year period of time. At the same time, the payment that the city was making into the system each year had gone up dramatically from about $1 million a year in 2002 to $9 million a year in 2015. That part of what was going on in our system is just what it was going on in every defined benefit system across the country. Other states and cities saw this kind of negative impact of the Great Recession. But we had some self-inflicted problems as well. Our fall had been greater, we had suffered more losses than others had. So we started this process in late 2013. We had a summit on the pension system that public employees participated in, as well as national experts and city councilors and our administration. And then we had about a year coming out of that. We had a year-long process that really tried to develop a shared understanding of what had happened here, what was the source of this problem, and what were we going to do to fix it. This gets really wonky really quickly, and I could go on and on about it, but here's the sum of what we've done is this. We made about 15 different changes to the way our plan works. Some of these were changes in the way we invest the dollars to save money and get higher returns. Some of these were changes in the way we administer the fund that gets into some of these kind of actuarial wonky details. And then also we had collective bargaining with our four public employee unions where the public employees are now paying more into the system and they are sharing some of the risk going forward in a way that they just hadn't been before. The net result of all this is we have not seen any increase for 3 years in a row now. That $9 million 2015 number is the same in 2016 and the same in 2017, and it's going to be the same for one more year by negotiation. We have also seen the funding percentage of the plan start to turn around. It's back up over 75% now, or about 75% now. And we are on a much stronger footing going forward. Have we solved this? No, you never really solve this. It's something that we'll need to continue to negotiate and grapple with. But we have saved taxpayers money. By the end of this tax year, the average household will have saved about $140 off of what they would have paid in taxes into the retirement tax. And that's going to continue out to 2020. Cumulatively, we'll have saved about $8 million for taxpayers and ratepayers by 2020.
I've got to go to a break, but I want to get this phone call in before we break. Let's go to Chris in Waterbury. Chris, you're on open mic with the mayor of Burlington.
Hey, good morning, Mike. Good morning, Mayor.
Good morning, Chris.
I applaud you for your efforts to try to solve the infrastructure problems and other problems here in your city. I'm a board member in the town of Waterbury. 2 years ago at town meeting, I approached the voters and explained to them what it was going to cost to fix up dilapidated paved roads in the town and village of Waterbury. And the result was the doubling of our property tax in order to do that. So economic development directors try to bring more business into town, figuring that's going to be the economic driver to help us with all this. But I try to explain to people that if you look around and show me one city where economic development has lowered your taxes, never seems to be the case, kind of like a dog chasing his tail. I kind of wonder when the people are going to decide that more is not better and start settling for less. I appreciate your time. Thanks.
Thanks, Chris. How do you respond to that?
Interesting question from Chris. I guess in the Burlington context, to get it right, we are not talking about doubling property taxes. We're talking about just, again, $3 more a month in the first year and a little bit more in the year after that and after that. Is it additional sacrifice? Yes. I do think it's critical that we do it. And, you know, as the president of the city council, Jane Nodell, said, she kind of summarized it well as part of the city council's unanimous endorsement of this plan. We can't really afford not to make this kind of investment. If you don't do this proactive investment, you end up with those middle of the night water repairs I was talking about before. You pay for it one way or another. I think you pay much less over time and have it and get it done right if you take this proactive approach.
When we come back, more with the mayor of Burlington, Mayor Moreau Weinberger. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. In studio with me this morning is Burlington Mayor Moreau Weinberger, who is we're going through some of the challenges that the city has, some of the things that are on the ballot item, some of the development that's going on in the city. I want to turn to police in a moment, but I also want to take a phone call. So let's go to the phone lines and Bob in Burlington. Bob, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Thank you. Hi, Mr. Mayor. This is a question back to the development of the mall. You've listed some positive aspects of the zoning change, which I find attractive. But when you get to the increasing height question from 105 feet to 160 feet, you always, including a few minutes ago, invoked a discussion with this developer for this project. So my question is, what's the justification for increasing height without referring to this project?
Great. Bob, I appreciate the question. Here's the justification. We went through this lengthy process called Plan BTV. It actually started before I was mayor, before Don Sinnix owned the mall. That was really, it's won national awards, at least regional awards, I think national awards, as a planning process. More than 1,000 Burlingtonians were involved. There was a huge online component to it where people weighed in on their preferences. And one of the clear findings that came out of that multi-year process was that the mall was an area of the town downtown that should be redeveloped, that it was an area specifically called out for as a place where you could have larger buildings without having the negative aesthetic impacts, that you wouldn't be impacting view corridors, you wouldn't be blocking public or private views the way you do in most other parts of the downtown. Excuse me. And it really laid out there this vision, reconnecting the streets, and said this is an area of the downtown that, because of the history and because of the geography, we can we have a real redevelopment opportunity. Don Sinnix read that part of our plan before, and that's what got him in part interested in purchasing the property. The area that we are attempting to redevelop with that logic includes the mall and a few properties next to it. It is a narrow slice of the downtown where we think these higher heights make sense and that can be accommodated. And, you know, I think this really in the truest sense comes straight from a deep public planning process.
Let me ask you this, sort of using Bob's question to sort of ask this question.
Sure.
Is this exclusive to this mall project? Because once you change the zoning, can't any building be 160 feet high?
Yes, any building in the zone. The zone is a relatively small zone. People should check out the map. And it includes the mall properties. It includes the Macy's site. Includes the city garages down the hill. That's the zone that was essentially called out in Plan BTV as an area that we should look to have a different zoning. And then that initial kind of conceptual thinking in the municipal plan has been buttressed by years of process where you have had this group it says, again, this sort of wonky term, but there's been this city council and public planning commission joint committee meeting for 2 years called the Form-Based Code Committee, which has been looking at the downtown zoning across the board. And that committee as well kind of called out this narrow slice. It basically said we're going to keep more or less the same height limits in the rest of the downtown. We're going to do some other changes in our zoning. But in this narrow zone, that should be treated differently. And so that's the distinction. And people should know that there are some people out there, I think, who are concerned that we say yes to this and all of a sudden you're going to have 14-story buildings going up all over downtown. No, the only place that would be allowed is in this narrow slice of the downtown.
We've had shootings of city residents by police in Burlington and elsewhere in Vermont and across our nation. What's your city doing to address this issue?
Well, we're doing a lot on policing. It's an area of where there's a lot of reform and work going on right now under the leadership of Chief Brandon Del Pozo. To just step back for the moment on this, one of the tougher decisions I've had as mayor is I had to replace a very popular, very effective police chief in Mike Sherling about 18 months ago. And as looking at that decision, I was very aware of the fact that we had this rising opiate challenge. We had this rising, these increasing problem with more and more mental health calls going to the police every year. We have different expectations for good reasons of our police officers now than we used to in the past. We want the use of force done in a different way than in the past. And so that's why I thought it was important when we ended up – I was looking for a reformer in a new chief, and we got that in Chief Del Pozo. And what are we doing about shootings? I mean, what first of all, he has brought community policing principles to the force. We have people, cops out on foot and on bicycle with a greater presence in areas of town that need it than we've had in the recent past. And we have also had, they're out explicitly trying to build community relationships with the communities they're policing. We also are really changing the way, we don't feel good about what happened with the Phil Grennan situation. That was a tragedy. Similar to the other shooting that happened in the New North End a few years back where there was another shooting. We are giving our officers a whole different level of training and a whole different set of tools to try to defuse these situations without violence in the future. It's something Chief Del Pozo is very committed to. We're working with a national group called the Police Executive Research Forum. We're really one of the cutting-edge police departments in the country on this. It's something we're very committed to.
Let's we're running out of time. I got like 90 questions here, but let's I wanted to get to the Burlington Airport. We won't be able to get that. I wanted to get to housing. We won't be able to get to that. But what issue keeps you up at night, and what issue excites you about being mayor?
Well, I've got two young girls, and I work as hard as I can in this job, and so usually by the time I hit the bed, I sleep pretty well. But I did. I was up last night a little bit before coming in, and I am concerned about not concerned, but it's just weighing on me how significant a decision we have on November 8th. The fact that after 2+ years of work on these two big initiatives, it now all comes down to a referendum. Which, looking around the world, we know referendums have pretty uncertain outcomes. I do just hope that Burlington voters have a chance to see all the information that's out there as they're making these decisions, because so much effort has gone into getting it to this point. There's a website, btvfuture.com, that is one source for good information about the ballot items. You can also go to the city's webpage, and we have an enormous amount of information there. What excites me? Well, I guess I'll say here's what excites me. I'm really proud of what we've done with the rebuilt Northern Waterfront. When you go down to the new skate park and the new bike path that's there, I get an enormous amount of positive impact from the kids and the mothers that are down there and have this wonderful new amenity. We have a chance to do that kind of good for the community, for the public, all over the city, in the downtown, with the stuff that's at Memorial Auditorium, with what we're working on, and I'm very excited about that future.
Thank you very much, Mayor Weinberger. I really appreciate you coming in.
It's been a pleasure, Micah. I'll hope to come back sometime soon.
Coming up, Talk Media News and David White talking about Vermont Development Conference. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. We have a glorious past, but we're celebrating the future. WDEV AM 550 broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, 98.3 FM from Montpelier, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. I'll be right back. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Coming up, Talk Media News, and then David White from White and Burke Investment Advisors. He's going to be talking about the Vermont Development Conference. It's my great pleasure to welcome to the Open Mic program from Talk Media News is Victoria Jones. Good morning, Victoria.
Good morning. So, Donald Trump has told the New York Post in an email that he is not going to go after Bill Clinton's affairs at the next debate, after all. He said he's going to take the high road. And I want to win this election on my policies for the future, not on Bill Clinton's past. Jobs, trade, ending illegal immigration, veteran care, and strengthening our military is what I really want to be talking about.
Seems to me that somebody's gotten to him and told him to start toning it down because you don't win going after the Clinton sex life. Is that what's happening here?
Well, the New York Times has a piece about how private polling by both parties shows a precipitous drop, even among independent voters, moderate Republicans, and women, according to a dozen strategists from both parties who spoke on the condition of anonymity because the data was confidential. That's for Trump, showing that his political problems could be worse than even his slide in the public polls. And Republicans are very worried about the effect down ballot.
We know what Donald Trump's strategy is to get back to the strategy he had before he sort of had the meltdown after the last debate. What is Clinton's strategy then?
Stop him. But at the same time, she wants to do what she does very well in these town halls and in these small settings with groups of individual people, which is where she does do well, and she enjoys these groups of small people, which is focus on the one-on-one and connect with individual voters, something she likes doing and something she does well. So she actually has quite a difficult job. She wants to focus on individual voters and connect with them personally, come across personally, talk about issues, and of course they have to answer their individual questions, so they're going to have to answer whatever questions are thrown at them. So she wants to come across very human, very much as a personal human being. I'm not saying that she's not, but you know what I'm trying to say here, not saying it very well. But at the same time, she wants to undermine Trump, and she wants to throw him off his game so that he doesn't succeed in doing what he wants to do, so that he goes off his own game. And he wants to not go off his game. And he's got 90 minutes to not go off his game.
One of the things that I was curious about, and I'm glad you're here to sort of help me with this curiosity, is that over the weekend there was this tape that was released where she sort of went after Bernie supporters, basically said they lived in their parents' basement and they were, I think, naive, I guess is the word. That's not what she said. This is the word that I'm using. Naive in thinking that they could change the world, that there could be a revolution instantaneously. Why did she do that? And doesn't that hurt her?
Well, it might. Bernie didn't seem to think it did. Bernie seemed to agree that they do live in their parents' basements because they can't afford to live anywhere else. And in fact, there's a new study out, and I wish I had it in front of me. Something like 60% of them do.
One of the things that is going on is the atrocities in Syria. What's happening there? Anything?
The atrocities go on, and it's systematic and very deliberate, the targeting of hospitals, particularly in Aleppo. The campaign by the Syrian government, backed by the Russians and Iranian militias and Hezbollah, is particularly against the Aleppo, which it was the biggest city in Syria and was its commercial hub and its industrial hub. So we're talking about a major city here, before the war, is divided into the east and the west, and the eastern part of the city is rebel-held, and it's completely cut off. Both parts of the city are cut off, but it's completely cut off, so you can't get in and you can't get out. So it's an old-fashioned siege, like a medieval siege in a castle, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So what they're trying to do is to either starve them out, force them into surrender, or kill them. And a lot of the deaths right now are of children. And so what they're also using now is these barrel bombs, bunker-busting bombs. Because so many of the hospitals have already been destroyed, they're now starting hospitals in caves and underground, under the rubble. They also have schools underground and under the rubble. So the Russians are using bunker-busting bombs that will penetrate the ground, and they deliberately. And so they are now deliberately bombing in a way that will penetrate the ground. You've got, of the few 35 or so doctors left, they are operating on the floors of emergency rooms, sometimes with no anesthetic. They have said in interviews that when really, really sick children come in, they have to leave them to die because they know that they cannot help them.
And what are we doing or what are we not doing there?
Well, we're not sending in troops. We're not providing enormous amounts of arms or anything like that. We committed a few days ago to more aid. But how does the aid get in? That hasn't been made clear, at least not to me. Some of the aid is going to refugee agencies. But again, how is the aid getting to Aleppo? There were the ceasefire, of course, is in tatters and has been since a convoy of aid was bombed. And investigations have indicated that it was bombed from the air, and it's believed that it was bombed by the Russians. The Russians deny that and are indicating that it was the Americans who did it with a drone. The Americans say that's rubbish. But the U.S. broke off talks with the Russians earlier this week. Secretary of State John Kerry broke off talks over a ceasefire earlier this week. Now, the U.N. is trying to get them back together. And Kerry and Sergei Lavrov, who's the Russian foreign minister, did actually have a phone call yesterday, which the State Department is saying, well, it doesn't mean to say that they're talking again. So the journalist was saying, well, they are talking again. He said, well, that doesn't mean to say they're talking. They're just talking.
Victoria, I want to sort of change quickly, and I know we're running out of time here, to Prime Minister May over in England. She seems to be saying, we're out of here with the EU. It seemed to me as I was reading these articles, this seems to be accelerated more than I expected. Is that, am I misreading this?
No, it did seem that it was going to be going slower than this, and she does seem to be speeding it up a bit. I haven't been following it as closely as I would normally, because I've been so focused on the election, but she has speeded it up, and part of that might be because she's needed to say some things. They have these party conferences in the autumn, each of the political parties do, so she's needed to speak to her party at the Conservative Party conference, so she's had some things to say, and but I do think that they feel that she feels that they need to start moving on this. And so, yes, it has speeded up.
Victoria Jones, as always, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Victoria Jones from Talk Media News. Coming up, David White. We're going to be talking about the Vermont Development Conference. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to have in studio, in our WDEV studios, David White from White & Burke Investment Advisors, Real Estate Investment Advisors. We're going to be talking, though, about the Vermont Development Conference. That's coming up November 2nd, I believe, in Burlington, at the Hilton in Burlington. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Mike.
What is the Vermont Development Conference?
Well, this is the third year we've done the Vermont Development Conference. It's an opportunity for all of those involved in the real estate development community in the state to come together, to network, and to really learn from each other. You know, one of the things that is significant is the quality of how we do development in Vermont. And sometimes it's so easy to be in your own little silo working on your own little piece. And that this is an opportunity to come together and step out of those silos. And so for the bankers, the attorneys, the wetlands experts, the engineers, the architects, the developers, et cetera, to all come together and to network and take seminars and really learn from each other.
So that is the importance of this, is to bring people together, and your hope and an accomplishment is this cross-pollination of talk.
Absolutely. You know, when we think about development in Vermont, the quality of development makes such a difference. We're a very, very different place than, I'd like to say, anywhere else in the world. I mean, we're a special, special state. And real estate development is such a critical part of our economy. I think it's easy for people to say, oh, geez, those developers and all the darn things they do. But the truth is that without real estate development, our economy would be in serious trouble. We need development for to provide housing for people. We need development for providing office space, for manufacturing space, for workshop space. It's a critical part of our economy. It creates jobs directly, but also provides the spaces we all use. So we need development. The question is not, do we have it? Is it a good thing? It is a good thing. But how do we do it? That's the key question. How do we do it in a way that's high quality, that serves Vermont well, protects the environment? And this is really about helping learn best practices to achieve those ends.
One of the things that I'm always curious about is that developers sometimes get the black hat. Is there a way of rebranding sort of the development field so that you have a white hat?
I would love it. I tell you, you know, I started my career in development in Vermont in the nonprofit and public sectors and shifted to the private sector. And I can't tell you the number of my friends who said to me, oh, you've gone to the dark side. And I said, now, wait a minute, time out. Who would you like to have doing development? Somebody who really cares about the quality of how things are done in the state, or somebody else who perhaps doesn't care so much? And they kind of, their eyes opened up. They said, oh, geez, I hadn't thought about it that way. Mm-hmm. Development is so important. And I don't know whether we can rebrand it. The truth is that it's really hard when you take what had been an open space and you put a building on it. And some people really liked that open space. And so it's finding how you balance that. And I, you know, I had to develop when I, particularly when I shifted to the private sector, which is now, you know, almost 30 years ago, that I had to develop a thick skin, because there are so many people who just look at me as wearing the black hat. But I don't think so. I think, in fact, you know, I and the vast majority of my colleagues, we're good guys. I mean, we live in Vermont by choice. And we really care about the state as much as everybody else, and we're trying to do the right thing and do it well.
So at the Vermont Development Conference, what are some of the – who comes to these events?
Well, it really is a wide array of those people who are involved in the industry. And when you think about real estate development, you know, people say, well, they're architects and engineers, but they're also landscape architects and bankers and attorneys and real estate brokers, interior designers. So it's really, there's quite a wide array who get involved. The construction industry. I mean, I look at our sponsors for this. You know, we've got PC Construction and Downs Racklin Martin, you know, one of the top law firms in the state who are our platinum sponsors. And that kind of range, I think, helps indicate who comes here and the cross-pollination that we hope will occur. And in fact, has occurred, and why people, we've sold out each year, and I'm quite sure we'll sell out this year.
So how many people will usually come to this event?
We cap it at 275. We really don't want it to get much larger than that. I think that gives us the full range of people, but still allows for some, you know, the intimacy.
275 in Vermont is a good sized conference.
It is indeed. It shows there's quite an interest in this, because again, we have sold out each year.
What are some of the subjects that you're going to be discussing this year?
Oh, geez. You know, development in Vermont is constantly evolving, and so we've got and there's so many issues where, whether it's best practices and how you approach it, or whether it's the regulatory regimes around it, or the market opportunities, that it's important to stay on top of those. So some of the topics include things like looking at environmental remediation. What are some of the best practices and creative solutions people have found to take brownfield sites and clean them up and be able to take them back into a productive use and redevelop them? I think benefits everybody in the state of Vermont when that occurs. Or there's a session on the economy and what's going on nationally, regionally, and in Vermont economically, and what does that suggest in terms of the opportunities that are going to be coming forward? We've got a session on what's happening with transportation and trains. What we have another session that you expressed interest in is we're having a session on marijuana legalization.
Yeah, I saw that on the agenda. How does that connect with development?
Well, when you think about it, without taking a position one way or another as to whether or not marijuana should be legalized, if it is, there are absolutely real estate implications. What does that mean in the permitting regime? How do you go about getting permitted for a marijuana operation? What kinds of facilities are needed for growing, processing, and distributing marijuana? What are the legal implications of that for the law firms that might work with companies and need to deal with the real estate side of how they get set up? what are the financing implications when it's still not legal nationally, and yet it may be legal in Vermont? What does that mean for the bankers involved? So, in fact, there's lots of real estate implications about that. And so we're just trying to get ahead of the curve. We don't know whether it's going to be legalized. And again, we're not taking a position on whether it should be. But if it is, there are real estate implications.
One of the other things I noticed is some emphasis on the environmental aspects. PFOA, for example, it's what has been detected in the Bennington area, has been detected in Chittenden County as well. Is that a growing concern with the development community, these environmental issues, whether it's PFOA or shoreline protection?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a growing concern, but it's a constant concern, and the emphasis changes as new concerns emerge. So that PFOA is being an example. Personally, I'd never even heard of them before a couple of years ago. I mean, it just suddenly burst onto the scene. And so this is an opportunity for people, and I include myself in this group, who really don't know a whole lot about PFOAs. So we want to learn so that if they become a factor on some property where any of us are interested in doing a project, we have an introduction and some idea of how to go about approaching it. The same with shoreline protection. There were significant changes in Vermont law just a couple of years ago relative to shoreline protection. And so what does that really mean if you're doing a project along a Vermont shoreline, not just Lake Champlain, but other shorelines around the state? And how does that affect how you might evaluate the feasibility of doing a project, as well as then what kinds of factors come into the design of that project if you proceed?
You deal with development every day, and of course this is going to be a conference of developers coming to this event. For the longest time, developers have been frustrated by the permitting process. Is that still an issue?
Oh, absolutely. There's a constant tension, I think, between on the development side, people who are saying, look, it's still a tremendous amount of duplication going on in the permit process. It can be at times more arbitrary and capricious than you would think. It supposedly should be according to the rules, but it's a human process, and it's not always about the rules, unfortunately. And it can be unpredictable in terms of time frame. I've got a project I'm working on right now where, you know, we're in our ninth year and still don't see the end in sight in terms of getting approvals for it. And I sincerely believe that it meets all of the rules and regulations, but there's some ardent opponents, and they're fighting it every step of the way. So it can be very, very frustrating at times. And I think, again, for myself, and I think I'm speaking for the vast majority of people in the development community, I have no objection to very clear, strong environmental and land use regulations. But let's go through the process once. I'll take wetlands as an example. There are, in some cases, I've got to go through four separate permit procedures to get a wetlands approval. If I'm going to have some impact on wetlands. I've got the Army Corps of Engineers. I've got the Agency of Natural Resources. Many local communities now have their own independent wetlands rules, and then also Act 250. And I may end up with contradictory answers from those various different permit regimes. I don't have any problem with very strong, robust wetlands permitting. I support that. But let's do it once, and let's do it well. Once, not even in criminal law, you can't have double jeopardy. But here I am doing, permitting for a project, and I've got to go through four different things covering the same issue. It's incredibly frustrating, and frankly, it wastes money for all concerned because it's easy to say, well, those darn developers, let them pay for it. That's their problem. But the truth is, the cost of that has to be recovered, and so it ends up in the price of the home, or it ends up in the lease rate of the commercial space, or whatever it is, and it adds, we all in the end, it's a backdoor tax in effect when we have those kinds of inefficiencies in the system, and we all end up paying for it. So that's the kind of area where there's frustration.
How do you fix that?
Well, we've been trying for years. And there are an awful lot of people who simply would rather see less development in the state and like it the way it is. And it's a constant tussle. I wish I had an easy solution. I wish that more in the legislature, frankly, were more receptive and really understood the kinds of inefficiencies and the implications for our economy and development in the state as a whole. But it's sometimes hard to get those messages across when the developers wear the black hat.
One of the things that I've heard listeners call in and say, we don't need any more development in Vermont. What's your response to that?
Oh, my goodness. If we had no more development in Vermont, our economy would tank. You know, let's look at just one narrow issue, which is the affordability of housing. It's incredibly expensive in Vermont relative to our income levels if you compare it to other places in the country. And that's one of the things that makes it hard for us to retain our young adults who are fleeing the state. And if we don't have more housing being developed, because even though we don't have a growing population to any significant degree, we do have, in fact, an increase in the number of households because average households are smaller and you need more housing to deal with those households. And without the growth in housing development, it becomes very, very hard for people to afford. And then you look the same with commercial development. It is the needs of particular industries changes, the needs in terms of retail changes, and making sure that we have the kinds of facilities that meet current needs is a significant part of our economy. Without that, we don't have the growth in the tax base. We don't have the growth in job opportunities. You know, it's just – so I go back to something I said earlier. The issue here, I think, is clearly not should we or should we not have development. We absolutely have to have development unless we want the economy to tank. The question is how do we do it? Where do we do it? And what's the quality with which we do it? And that's a lot of what this conference is about.
We're speaking with David White, who's with White & Burke Real Estate Investment Advisors. And we're talking about the Vermont Development Conference, which is coming up on November 2nd. It's where developers get together to discuss issues on development in Vermont. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. If you have a comment, if you have a question about development in Vermont, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. When we come back, more discussion about development in Vermont and also your phone calls. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with David White, who's in studio here with us from White & Burke and Real Estate Investment Advisors. And we're talking about the Vermont Development Conference. It's a conference where approximately 275 developers get together on November 2nd and talk about issues of development in the state of Vermont. And David, sort of my question is, why should we, not developers, be interested in this conference? Not that we have to go to it, but why is it important that you get together and have this conference?
Well, Mike, you know, I think it all has to do with best practices. As I said before the break, real estate development is incredibly important to our economy and to our state and to our ability to, you know, retain young people in the state and to, you know, provide jobs and so forth. And so we all have an interest in seeing development occur. But as we all know, development can be very controversial in Vermont. And so the interest I think that the general public has is in seeing that when development occurs, that it does happen in the right places and with the right kinds of environmental protection so that it's quality development. And this conference is really about best practices. How do you go about doing things well? As an example, one of our sessions is on financing. And where you've got a situation that is so often the case, particularly in downtowns and particularly in some of the smaller communities, frankly, any place outside of Chittenden County, it's really hard to make the economics work for a private sector development, whether it's office building or retail or what have you, in many cases, even residential in the core of downtown. So how do you go about financing those things? And we've got a whole session on creative financing and how do you package together alternative sources of financing, sometimes tax credits and so forth, to make projects within our downtowns viable that might not otherwise occur. And I think we all have an interest in having those kinds of things happen. So it's best practices, it's gaining skill sets and helping each of us from our hands-on experience doing successful projects, or in some case what we learned from projects that weren't successful, help others learn so that we can do better projects that benefit everybody.
There seems to be a conflict in Vermont where there seems to be a push to build downtowns, and yet we see a lot of development outside of downtowns. Why?
Well, there are a lot of reasons for that. Frankly, part of the reason why development happens outside of downtowns is because of the zoning in place. If it's zoned for a certain use, let's say it's zoned for retail, and you're looking to develop a retail store of some sort, you're going to look at the zoning and see where it's allowed. And so in many cases, it's put exactly where the local zoning wants it or says it should be and allows it, even if there are other people in the community who say, wait a minute, we didn't want it there. We want it elsewhere. But the rules are the rules. And you, as somebody doing development, you look at those rules and analyze them and figure out where it can go. But another is that in many cases, it's much cheaper to do. It's very complicated and expensive in downtown to assemble sometimes a large enough parcel of land. Sometimes you've got old utilities that crisscross the property you're trying to develop. Sometimes you have issues about building next to a foundation of another building because downtowns are much, typically the buildings are much closer. You have frequently much more expensive with respect to parking is one of the biggest issues. So it really is, although it's specific to each project, there are a lot of factors that come into play on that. And one of the things we've seen in recent years, and it's been a slow effort and it still, I think, has a ways to go, is for the state through and municipalities through various rules and regulations to, in fact, make it easier to develop, to take away barriers to the extent that they can. Some of them they can't control. But if they can make it easier to get through a permit process in a downtown, for example, that is a step that helps make it more likely that that's where those projects will occur.
Before I change to what's the greatest need in Vermont from a development perspective, one of the things that I get confused about when we're talking about permitting is we talk about environmental permitting and we talk about land use permitting. How do those two intersect in Vermont?
Well, they're very closely tied to each other. They are conceptually perhaps separate. Land use permitting, simply speaking, you could think of as zoning, in which a municipality designates certain specific geographic areas for different types of uses. One might be for high-density housing, another for single-family homes, another for commercial, another for industrial. And the idea historically has been that it's good to keep those uses largely separate in order to protect the character of a particular neighborhood, in order to protect property values in that neighborhood, and so forth. That's been changing somewhat in recent years. I'm going to go off on a tangent for just a moment here, as people have started to realize that doing that has required us, has been based on the automobile society, and it means you've got to drive from where you live to where you work and drive from where you work to where you shop and so forth. And then in some cases, having mixed-use neighborhoods and mixed-use zones actually have benefits, a la downtowns, where somebody might live there and work there and shop there. And so some of the thinking around land use permitting is changing slowly, and there's some controversy around that. But that is changing. But nonetheless, that has to do with where do you put things and what kinds of rules are around that. How much density can you have on it? How many square feet per acre or what have you? How many units per acre of housing? Environmental permitting has more to do with protecting an environment. So stormwater permitting or wetlands impacts or protecting rare and endangered species, those sorts of elements. But they do overlap because a lot of zoning ordinances today have environmental elements to them. And Act 250, which also deals with land use through particularly Criterion 10, which has to do with conformance with local and regional plans, has a lot of environmental issues, and in fact, that's really at the core of it. So there's not a clear distinction as the two overlap greatly, but conceptually they are somewhat separate.
One of the things that I'm interested in your opinion, and we're speaking with David White from White & Burke Real Estate Investment Advisors. He's a developer. We're talking about development in Vermont, and we're also talking about the Vermont Development Conference. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. If you have a comment or an issue with development in Vermont, give us a call. From your perspective, David, what's the greatest need in Vermont from a development perspective?
Well, there are a number of ways to answer that question, Mike, but let's talk about it for a moment from a market perspective. because no project's going to be viable unless there's market demand for it. And so you really have to start with the question of where's the demand. And right now, frankly, the demand is primarily in housing. It's not that there aren't other opportunities commercially, but we don't have a tremendous amount of growth going on in industry or a tremendous amount of growth going on in office demand or in retail. There is some. I'm not saying there are no opportunities there, but I don't think in terms of the volume of market demand, it's currently as strong in those commercial arenas as it is in residential. That said, if I think about it from a public policy and planning perspective, housing is incredibly important. In fact, one of our sessions at the Vermont Development Conference is on the Building Homes Together initiative that's taking place in Chittenden County, where the nonprofit community and public sectors are partnering up with private developers trying to encourage development of 3,500 units of housing within the Chittenden County area over the next 5 years. It's a very important, significant public-private partnership initiative. But from a policy perspective, I think we need to grow the economy more, too. And housing is a piece of that, creates construction jobs, but you have to also have other kinds of jobs. And so the real estate development demand may not be there for a tremendous amount of commercial development, but from a policy perspective, I think it's very important that we be encouraging that.
We're speaking with David White from White & Burke Real Estate Investment Advisors. We're talking about development in Vermont. If you have a question, concern, comment about development in Vermont, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. And the reason we're talking about development is that approximately 275 developers will be getting together on November 2nd at the Vermont Development Conference in Burlington to talk about development in Vermont. Let's go to the phone lines and let's go to Fred in Newberry. Fred, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Morning. I think the big problem with developers in this state and everybody else is high taxes. I counted 7 taxes this state has. I mean, it's crazy. If you have high taxes, it takes money out of the economy. If you take money out of the economy, developers aren't going to have any money to develop. Why are the kids leaving? No jobs. Why are there no jobs? High taxes.
Does tax policy have an impact on development?
Oh, absolutely it does. When you look at particularly the operating costs, if you're doing a commercial development project, taxes can be a substantial portion of the operating costs of that facility, and those end up being passed through to the tenants, and it makes it harder for those tenants, if they're high taxes, for them to be able to pay their rent and afford the rent, and thus it's harder for them to have a feasible business or grow their business. So there's no question tax policy has an implication for all of us. That said, there's a real balance between on the one hand, the cost implications in development of taxes. On the other side, the services that we also receive. I mean, let's face it, that without the roads and the highways and the water and sewer facilities and so forth that are supported by our taxes and our good school system, what we hope is good school system as it is in most of the state, it would be very hard also. So it's how do you balance those things?
When you're developing something, you usually put your cost in to see what your rate of return is going to be on your investment.
Yes.
I think that's the whole thing about development.
Absolutely.
Is making sure that you do get a return on your investment. As you plug in the taxes, is there a possibility sometimes that can make a project or bust a project?
Well, rarely is it any one factor. Usually it's a death by 1,000 cuts. You get the taxes are a little bit higher than you'd like them to be. You have some new permit conditions that are put on that add costs. You get told that you can't build as many units or as large square footage as you'd like to, so it reduces your revenue. And all those things kind of add up, and gradually you go, this no longer makes economic sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't want to point just at taxes. It really is a death by 1,000 cuts. It's each one of those incremental things. And let's face it, in Vermont, it is just as expensive to build here as it is many other places in the country. But we don't have the kind of rental rates. We don't have the kind of sales prices that many other places have, particularly in the commercial arena. In the residential, we do have fairly high rates. But in the commercial, less so. So it's very hard to make projects pencil. And so you start to chip away around the edges that way, and taxes being a piece of that, yeah, it can make a, all the difference as to whether or not a project is feasible.
Let's go to Sam in Williston. Sam, you're on open mic with David White from White & Burke Real Estate Investment Advisors, and we're talking about development in Vermont.
Yes. The one thing you brought up was the wind development. That's a hot topic, a hot button issue for a lot of people. But besides that, you have the project down in downtown Burlington with the new mall and adding on to its height. Now, how do you protect the view? How do you sell a piece of property to somebody and say, you have a gorgeous view of the lake, you have a gorgeous view of the mountains here, and then next thing you know, the developer comes in and steps on that view? And it's kind of like, are we going to kill the goose? We are a beautiful state, and there's a lot of good things about our state. Are we going to kill the golden goose with our looks to have development that may or may not benefit us? I personally don't see how this wind energy situation doesn't help us in many ways. It's just a feel good thing.
Let me interject here and try to get to a question. I wish you, Sam, you would have called in the first hour when the mayor was here of Burlington. But the aesthetics in terms of projects, how do you sort of balance that? I mean, Sam brings up the fact that it's, you know, 160 feet tall project in the town center project down in downtown Burlington. There's the wind aspect of development, which the aesthetics of the ridge lines come into play. How do you balance that?
Well, that's a tough policy question that I think the legislature and people in individual municipalities have been struggling with now for years. And I've personally not been involved in any wind projects, and it's not something that I feel particularly knowledgeable to talk about, to be honest. I do think aesthetics are a legitimate issue. That said, we can sometimes overregulate aesthetics. As I look at the Burlington Town Center project, frankly, I'm a strong supporter of that project. I think it's astonishing that we've got a developer willing to come in who understands Vermont and is willing to come in and spend $200 million redeveloping that dying center, reopen the streets, and to really make something that is more a community and integrates more into the community rather than sitting separate from it, albeit in the middle of the community. And as I talked about death by a thousand cuts, that redevelopment is going to be unbelievably expensive, and it's a high-risk proposition. And it seems to me that that the added height is not going to have a substantial impact on people's views. It's actually downhill from much of the city in terms of where the views are, and you're going to look over the top of it. And yes, you can look up to it, but you look up to other buildings in Burlington today, and I'm not sure that it's going to have that as much aesthetic impact as people fear it will have. And I think there's also an argument to be said that it may actually be a positive impact. As I think about density and the importance of trying to grow our downtowns, because the probably single most important core principle that planners in Vermont have been talking about now for 20, 30 years is let's maintain that sharp distinction between our dense development in downtowns and village centers versus rural countryside and not sprawl out into rural countryside. And here we've got a developer proposing to spend a tremendous amount of money to do that kind of density. And yes, it's change. And one of the things, Mike, that I've come to believe over the course of my career is that we as a species are inherently conservative. We hate change. And it even if it's good change, even if it's mom and apple pie change, but it's a different apple pie, maybe, you know, mom wanted to do blueberry instead of apple, people hate change and just have this visceral reaction to it. And more often than not, in this kind of arena, my experience is afterwards they go, oh, you know, that's not that bad. And sometimes people eventually come around to, you know, I actually kind of like that. I really support that density. I support that height. I think it's very important to making that a viable project. And if we let this opportunity go away, we may see that center moribund for years and years to come.
I want to, when we come back, we're going to take a short break here, but when we come back and we're speaking with David White from White & Burke Real Estate Investment Advisors, and we're talking about the subject of development because there's going to be an upcoming conference on development, the Vermont Development Conference on November 2nd. When we come back, I want to change the subject a little bit and talk about demographics in this state and whether that has an impact on development. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with David White from White & Burke Real Estate Investment Advisors, and we're talking about the Vermont Development Conference that brings about 275 developers to Burlington. It will happen this year on November 2nd, and we're talking about development in Vermont in general. Demographics. Do demographics have an impact on development in Vermont?
Absolutely. In some ways, they're at the core because, as I stated earlier, this is all about market demand, and developers are responding to needs in the marketplace and demand for some kind of product, whether it's housing or rental housing or for sale housing or office space in the marketplace. And demographics are at the core of that. And one of the challenges that we're facing as a state is that we have had very, very little growth in population over the last decade, and there's very little projected for the next decade. So that's factor one. If you don't have a lot of growth going on, it limits demand of any sort. It doesn't get rid of it, but it limits it. It puts some real boundaries around it, very different than what might be going on in a state that has more growth occurring in population. But then there are two other major factors that are coming into play here. One is the depopulation of some of the smaller communities, because while the state as a whole is not growing, Chittenden County is, but it's growing at the expense of a lot of the other counties in the state, where people are – those some of those counties are actually seeing absolute declines in population while the Chittenden County area is growing. And so on a whole, the state's balanced out to some extent with limited growth occurring, but it does mean – there may be more opportunity for increased development or additional development in the Chittenden County area, and less so, and it's going to be much, much harder to get projects going on in a lot of the smaller areas and other counties in the state. Again, it doesn't mean there's no opportunity, but it's going to be less so. The third factor that's involved here with demographics is the shifting in the ages, the age cohorts in population. As you see, the baby boom generation, of which I think you and Mike may be examples, as we are getting into our golden years, let's say, our needs are different than those of young people and people, first coming young adults and forming families and so forth. And what we're seeing in Vermont.
You need a bigger basement, right? No, I'm just kidding.
But, for our age cohort, there are needs for some smaller housing units. There are some needs for senior housing units and so forth. But then on the other side, because we don't have as much, we're seeing not just a decrease in percentage, but in absolute numbers of young adults. It means that we don't have as much household formation going on as we would otherwise. And that's a big impact in terms of what the market opportunities are, as well as a big impact on our economy as a whole.
Does technology affect development? And I guess that's a broad question, but does it affect development in terms of efficiency of development, or does it in fact affect where we develop?
Well, I actually think technology affects development in a different way than either of those. And the most significant impact has to do with the technologies that are being used to build more efficient buildings, so that we've got the whole net zero movement that's trying to move toward how do we develop buildings that have a net zero need for importing energy. That means you build tighter buildings. That means you use more efficient lighting and heating systems. That means you may have solar energy panels on your rooftops. How do you go about building buildings that require less, particularly carbon-based type energy? And those sorts of trends are huge in the development industry right now in Vermont. And I think those are the biggest areas of technological impact.
David White, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Open Mic.
Mike, very happy to be here.
That's David White from White & Burke Real Estate Investment Advisors. And the topic we've been talking about is the Vermont Development Conference. If you're a developer, you need to be there on November 2nd in Burlington. You can find more information by going on to where, David?
Go to whiteandburke.com.
Thank you very much, David. I also want to thank our other guest, Mayor Weinberger, for joining us today, and Victoria Jones from Talk Media News. And, of course, I want to thank all of you for your phone calls today. Tomorrow, we'll have a week in review with some reporters from the various news outlets. And then it's Free for All Friday. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio. I'm the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. Yep, we've had a glorious past, but we're celebrating the future. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, 98.3 FM from Montpelier, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. Thank you for your phone calls. Have a great rest of your day, and we'll talk again tomorrow.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker, and Brown.
Find us online at HBinsurance.com, and you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.